going red. And the musically, 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 hey. Lee Scratch stays on the wire. Lee Scratch stays with a holy ball of fire. You like it, and the story at the fire. Well, I come out to scratch it.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
Do you realize our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is September 3rd. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenka Haka, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back on 90.3 FM.
Cauliflower. Flower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Cam.
See, wait. Fan roofsy. You. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. We're going to start the hour with elections ahead of the September 20th vote. This evening, we're going to be joined by Laura Mariani, who is running as the Green Party candidate for the Dorval-Lachine-LaSalle riding. Laura is a longtime resident of the West Island and holds an engineering degree from McGill University, specializing in steel manufacturing, and also holds professional certificates in management and data analytics for business. She has also spearheaded several environmental initiatives in the community, including a zero-waste challenge, a 10,000-square-foot pollinator garden, and a home energy audit kit. She believes our country must pull together to deal with the climate crisis. To that end, Laura favors a science-based strategy focused on innovation in agriculture, steelmaking, cement production, and developing a national food waste strategy and passing a right-to-repair laws. Other issues close to Laura's heart include improved services for Canadians with disabilities and increased funding for research into women's health issues. In her spare time, Laura enjoys reading, gardening, and sharing her enthusiasm for native plants.
I'm just going to ask you a few simple questions and let you talk about why exactly you think that people should vote for you for office.
Yeah.
So, all right. So your educational background is a degree in process engineering from McGill, specializing in steel manufacturing. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your professional background. What's led you to offer your candidacy for the Green Party, and what do you think your experience can bring to climate-centered policy and legislation?
Great question. This is exactly what I want to be talking about. So, yes, I have degrees from McGill in metallurgical engineering and materials engineering. And throughout my career, I did different things, and sort of serendipity or by accident, I ended up working in a steel mill for a few years. So I was the process engineer in a steel mill. Very interesting experience. Most people don't get to see industrial processes right up close. So it's a difficult place to work, but it's really interesting. And then I moved back to Montreal and bought a house and had a baby. I wanted to transition out of working directly in heavy industry. So I became a consultant as a process engineer specialized in steelmaking. I do other stuff, but steelmaking is really my main interest. So about steelmaking, here's what your listeners need to know about steelmaking. Steelmaking is an incredibly greenhouse gas emission intensive process. Like the main output of steelmaking, the main secondary byproduct of steelmaking is carbon dioxide. We produce an enormous amount of carbon dioxide. But of course, people don't know because people don't really think about how steel is made, right? So globally, steelmaking is the second most carbon dioxide intensive industry after cement. So that's terrible. But as an environmentalist, that's great because that means I get to work on something that has a real impact directly. So my whole group where I work, we're involved in many projects that are working towards decarbonizing steelmaking. So some of them are working with existing steel mills, trying to figure out where they can cut their carbon dioxide emissions. And this is a bit difficult because some of these were built like 70 years ago and they have certain processes and certain equipment that they already have. And steelmaking is a very low margin business. They don't have a lot of money to spend. So we're trying to figure out ways to help them. On the other side, there's some really exciting innovations happening right now in steelmaking where people are starting to look towards making fossil-free steel. So what that means is usually in a steel furnace, you use a lot of coal as an energy source. So there's a certain process whereby you can use hydrogen instead and you sort of make some adaptations. Same idea, but there's some adaptations. And right now we're starting to see that in Sweden. There's a steel mill in Sweden that already uses this process. And my group and I were working on another steel mill also in Sweden that will use this process. So here's what you need to know. Okay, so I said it's hydrogen, right? So it starts with extracting hydrogen from water. So to need that, you need a lot of water and you need a clean energy source. So in this case, hydroelectricity. So you extract the hydrogen from the water and the hydrogen is used to extract iron from iron ore. And then after that, it's processed in a very similar way. So the key things I just said here were water and hydroelectricity. That's exactly what we have right here in Canada, especially right here in Quebec. So I'm really asking, why are we able to do this in Sweden? And in Canada, not only we're not doing it, we're not even really talking about it yet. So oftentimes when we're talking about the environment, we're talking about what we can do at the individual level. And we're saying, you know, don't forget your reusable bag when you go to the grocery store, you know, stuff like that. And that's good. I mean, it's certainly good. It makes us feel good that we're doing something. But while we're busy making these really incremental changes in our own life, what we're not thinking about is, as I said, heavy industry. How is stuff made? And it's because most of us don't know about it. We don't really think about it. So it's not, and it's not something that we have any personal input into. So the average person can't control how cement is made. The average person can't control how steelmaking is made. But this is somewhere where I would hope that we would see more leadership from the federal government instead of subsidizing oil and gas, as we're currently doing, to the tune of $18 billion a year. We could be funding research and development into steelmaking, cement making, agriculture, all our industries where we have a high rate of production of greenhouse gases. So that's really where I want to get to, like funding our universities, funding the National Research Center, funding businesses that are working on this to see if we can actually make a significant reduction in our greenhouse gases. Like just taking your reusable bag to the grocery store, it's not really enough. And right now, you know, the federal government's talking about these details, like we're going to outlaw plastic straws, you know? And it's like, when we talk about the least we can do, that is literally like the least we can do. So if we need to move forward faster, and we need to really concentrate on our heavy industry.
Yeah, well, because I found it very interesting that you're running for the Green Party and that you worked in the industrial sector. And you noticed, I noticed that you mentioned in your candidacy profile that you talked a bit about science-based strategy. So I guess that's where a lot of what you were just saying a while ago. Could you just tell us a little bit about what would that mean for the average worker, say somebody who works at the steel mills, and for somebody like me, like I used to be a welder. So this is something that would have interested me, and well, it still interests me today. And I just want to know what your thoughts were on that.
Well, to be honest, the like average working person doesn't have that much input or that much control over where they work. Like usually, you know, you need to pay your rent, so you kind of get whatever job you can. But ideally, especially since I imagine it's a lot of students who listen to your program, I expect that in the next couple of years, we're going to see a trend of young people preferring to move into industries and businesses that seem to have a sincere climate change strategy. So I'm an engineer. I went to school like 20 years ago. We weren't having the same conversations then. And not at McGill, but at this example, University of Calgary, or the oil and gas program was huge at that time. I recently read that they're actually going to phase it out because there's just not enough young people who are interested in working in that sector. So I do think we're going to see a trend of younger people being more selective about where they work. Again, I mean, I understand you're young, you're getting your first job, you don't have that many choices, but I do think that, let's say, dirtier industries are going to have a harder time recruiting younger people. And even for like mid-stage professionals, you know, now you're at a stage in your life where you do have a little bit more choice of where you work. People are going to move into industries and businesses that where they feel that they're making an impact. Like, I mean, you can just work and get a paycheck. That's okay. But I think people are looking for something that's a little bit more coherent with their values.
And I noticed too, like, you said that the new process for steel manufacturing, or a lot of it uses a lot of water. How much impact do you think that would have on the environment? Or is it a really a heavy water use industry?
Okay, so that's a great question. So most of the water that's used in steelmaking is recirculated. So it's used for cooling, but we're not using more clean water all the time. It's just, you know, the same water recirculates around in the pipes. However, that's true that part of the process that I was talking about, where we crack the water to extract hydrogen and then the other output is oxygen. That's true. That will use a lot of water. Unfortunately, I don't have all the facts and figures of like how much of an environmental impact that will make. I think that comes down to the hard choices that we have to make and the compromises that we'll have to make. I mean, it's unfortunate, but from a pragmatic standpoint, like we think about, let's say, like I'm talking about steel and cement. I think people in the first world want to keep their nice standard of living, and then we can expect people in developing countries to be increasing their consumption of iron and steel, which I'm certainly not against. I mean, people need to have adequate housing, especially when we see like earthquake zones, and it's because their buildings are not constructed with materials that are strong enough. So we're going to see even more consumption of iron and steel. So our choice is either do we try and find a better way of making it, or do we keep making it the way we've been doing it, but making less is not an option. So it's a little bit about the overall picture of reducing harmful impacts, but there's no free rides. Like, you're not gonna, well, I mean, maybe you will, maybe I will, somebody will find the perfect way that has no detrimental impacts, but unfortunately we're not there yet. Since you brought it up, there is an even newer, more exciting development in steel making, which is like a completely different process that uses electrolysis, but it's a couple decades away from commercialization. So we're not going to see it yet, but you know, people are working on other stuff, but we're not there yet. So I didn't answer the question because I'm not a politician trying to avoid the question. The answer is I don't know. And now I'm curious. So I'm going to find someone who does know and maybe get back to you later if I do find an answer.
Okay. You've also stated in your candidate profile that you have led a number of community initiatives, one of which was a zero waste challenge, another was a pollinator garden, and a home energy audit kit. Could you tell us a little bit more about these initiatives and if they were successful and what the community response has been from these?
Yeah, so just to set the stage here, I am just an average person. I don't have a lot of resources. I am literally, you know, just a regular individual. But when I was on my maternity break, I would walk around my neighborhood for like hours at a time with my son, trying to get him to sleep. And, you know, just kind of like thinking about what I could do, like little projects, because I wasn't working at the time and I still wanted to do something interesting. So I got a couple like ideas, again, just sort of thinking about my son and what I could do to make things better for him. So I came up with these ideas and I came up with some proposals and lobbied my my city to adopt them. And I have had a pretty good response. In fact, the response was so good that I've been invited to run for city council. So I'm actually in two elections at the moment, which is pretty exciting. So one of them, the home energy audit kit, that's an idea that I imported from Edmonton. So when I lived in Edmonton, this energy kit came out and it was available at the library and it was extremely popular. Like the waiting list was like hundreds of names long. And it's like a little suitcase and it has like all the tools you'd need to do a home energy audit, like a thermal camera, stuff like that to see where you're losing heat in your home, where you need to put a little extra insulation. And I thought it was such a great idea and like so simple. And many people here in my neighborhood, we live in older homes. So, you know, we're all looking to save money. So I was lucky to get a good reception from that one, from our city. It's only recently been made available at the library. It was a little bit delayed due to the pandemic. So I hope, I certainly hope that it's popular, that people try it out, you know, first for a few days. You borrow it for free from the library and you can end up saving hundreds of dollars on your home heating bill. That's a great idea to use less energy. One of my other ideas was hosting a year-long zero waste challenge. So unfortunately, we did have to scale it back a little bit because of the pandemic. So we're not having some of our initiatives like the Repair Cafe and some other in-person events that we want to hold. But what we do is we have a newsletter that comes out every couple months that gives people ideas on how they can reduce waste in their own homes. We host workshops. So we're going to have a workshop about waste in the garden, how you can prepare your garden for winter, but also like meal planning, how to reduce food waste in your home, how to host a zero waste gathering. We've shown documentaries. There's one about fast fashion called The True Cost that we showed, another Addicted to Plastic that we showed. So yeah, it's been going pretty well. I do admit because of the pandemic, it's a little bit slower than I would have liked, but as I said, it's pretty positive to the point we're talking about, okay, this is just our first year. What are we doing next year? And we're going to incorporate this other idea next year. So I've been pretty pleased with that. Again, it's about gaining awareness, which is difficult to do when everybody's in their home, but sure. I think it's a great idea. I'm glad everybody's participating in it. And one of the other ideas that was accepted was a 10,000 square foot pollinator garden. So one of my hobbies and interests is planting and promoting native plants. So people have beautiful gardens, but they think about, you know, tulips, which come from Central Asia. They think of daffodils, which come from Europe, but they don't think of planting the plants that are native to our area. And we have beautiful, colorful, amazing plants, but, you know, people don't know about them. So I plant them here at my home, and I've kind of made it a personal crusade to get my municipality to plant them too. So we're starting to prepare a 10,000 square foot garden that will be a demonstration garden so that residents can see that native plants are beautiful, they're colorful, give them some design ideas so they can adopt these principles in their home gardens.
Yeah, that sounds like a really great idea. I know my mom has a native garden out in the back, and I have a hummingbird that comes visit us every morning, and it's a really nice thing to have. And that's all the questions I had for this evening. It was really great talking to you.
Sure. Well, I thank you very much for hosting me. One thing I just want to leave your listeners with is to remind them, if I can run for federal parliament, literally anybody can. I'm just an individual. I don't have a lot of rich backers. It's just me. And if federal elections may be a step too far for you, try your municipal election. You know, if we really need everybody to get involved so we can move forward. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize, that we need a diversity of perspectives, a diversity of experiences, because we have some really big problems that we need to solve. So we really need everybody. So I really invite everybody to think about where you can contribute. One final thought that I wanted to share, if I just have a couple more minutes, but I just want to let everybody know what's involved. What does it mean when you become a federal candidate? Because, like, as I said, if I can do it, you can do it too. So it's not that hard. So step one, you apply to your party of choice. In my case, the Green Party. Join whatever feels comfortable, you know, for you. And then you would write like a letter of motivation to say why you're interested. There's a vetting process where they check your social media posts and your credit history to make sure that you're, I would say, like a reasonably competent person, that you're not like super racist or whatever. And then once you've been confirmed as the nominee for your riding, you have to get 100 signatures from people who live in your riding. They don't have to vote for you. It's just to confirm that you're a real person and that you're a serious candidate. You send that into Elections Canada with a little bit more paperwork, but it's not that complicated. And voila, you are a federal candidate. So as I said, it's actually not that hard. So far, it has not cost me any money. So don't worry about that part. Like, if it's actually not that hard, and it shouldn't be reserved only for, I'd say, people with connections or people, you know, have a lot of money or a lot of time. I don't have a lot of time, and I can figure out how to do this. So if you're interested, try it out. We need it. Interested and energetic people in our parliament.
We need more young people in our parliament to represent us, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've had a lot of people tell me like, oh, I'm not interested in politics. I'm like, maybe you're not, but politics is interested in you, and it affects your daily life, you know, how, you know, your tax dollars are being spent. So if you want to say, you at minimum vote, but remember, voting is the minimum you can do, but get involved. Question your MP, write letters to your MP, let them know what your concerns are, because otherwise other people are going to make the decisions for you. You didn't speak up when you had the chance.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
CKUT Radio.
Soundwaves in the air.
CKUT
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to Green Party candidate Laura Mariani. Now for the second segment of the hour, we're going to keep talking about the election, but from a different perspective.
Welcome back, warriors. Tunse Sego Ani Buju, Kwe Nindeluizi Pam Pometer, and I am the host of this show, The Warrior Life. This podcast is a show about living the warrior life, a lifestyle that focuses on decolonizing our minds, bodies, and spirits, while at the same time revitalizing our cultures, traditions, laws, and governing practices. And it's also about asserting, living, and defending our sovereignty all over Turtle Island. And I have to say, quite crankly, that while we were all enjoying seeing our friends and family again and enjoying getting back to powwows, our summer was rudely, and I might add unnecessarily, interrupted by a federal election. And you know what that means. It means that we have to bring back the one and the only Turtle Island's own political affairs correspondent, Negan Sinclair. Yeah, I know. What kind of friend am I to Negan that I would interrupt his summer to ask him to come onto the Warrior Life podcast and talk election politics with us? Well, that's how dedicated I am to our listeners, that I would take that risk and ask him to come on here. And for those of you who are new to the planet, Negan covers Indigenous issues all over Canada, US, Mexico, and when necessary, in other colonial countries which commit injustices against Indigenous peoples. And he has all the credentials too. Not only was he brought up and grounded in his traditional Anishinaabeg culture, but Negan is also an associate professor at the University of Manitoba in the Department of Native Studies, and he's a prolific public speaker and media commentator. I literally listen to what he has to say on all of these issues every day. Like we mentioned before, he's an award-winning author and an award-winning columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press. But in order for him to maintain the title of Turtle Island's political affairs correspondent, I think we're going to have to give him a little test first. So what do you have to say about that, Negan?
I'm still in shock that you're calling me the only person. Like, I'm just imagining all the people who are now mad.
not the only, you're the.
Wonderful, but not good when you insult them.
So what do you think? Welcome to the show, by the way.
You know, bonjour, everybody. Thanks for having me, as usual. Good morning from Treaty 1 territory over here. Of course, homeland of my people, the Cree, the Oji-Cree, Dakota, Lakota, and then a homeland of the Métis Nation. It's nice to see everyone. We are in the middle of a federal election, whether we want it or not. And I think the fact is that we're in lots of different crossroads, and I'm glad to be here. This is, of course, my job, so this is not something that, like, I'm itching at the to do in terms of talking about a federal election, but I'm very happy to be here and very happy to do this with you. I'm so happy. In fact, I'm doing this on a Sunday morning. So there you go.
Oh yeah, I know. See, just even worse. And by the way, also interrupt your weekend. Okay. Well, before we get into the election questions, I did say we were going to test you. So we're going to do a speed round of who said this to see if you really know your Canadian politics. Now,
I didn't know that I have a note saying that I have exemptions from testing. So
exemptions from testing.
I'll do the test, but if I fail, then I want you to know that I wasn't supposed to do it in the first place.
Okay. So, we're hoping that you get the name of the person and their political party, but one or the other, that would be good. Okay, are you ready?
Stockwell Day. Okay. Did we not start yet? Sorry.
No, okay. Here's the first quote. There is no relationship more important to Canada than the one with Indigenous peoples.
Okay, Lucienne Bouchard. I think that's a funny political joke.
Yeah.
Obviously, Justin Trudeau and the Liberals. And one of the very first things he said as Prime Minister, which... literally, like, the ink wasn't dry on the election, and there he was saying that from the get-go. And I remember when he said that, I turned to my sister beside me, because it was at the TRC final report, and I turned to my sister and I said, "Oh my God, the Indian Act's done." And nope, the Indian Act's here.
It was literally his mantra. He said it at every event. It was in all of the mandate letters for all of his ministers. Literally, they had the same thing in all of those mandate letters. So it was like his first 4 years, that was just over and over and over again. There's no relationship more important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder what his wife has to say about that. But anyways, okay. All right, here we go.
Yeah, okay. So the next one's sort of related. Who said this? Trudeau doesn't give a fuck about Indigenous rights.
I did. That was me. I said that.
We're excluded.
No, of course it was Romeo Saganash, and who now is a Winnipeg resident here and working very hard on Leah Kazan's campaign. We see him on the streets. Romeo has become like a quasi-Manitoban right here in Treaty 1 territory. And, you know, great respect for Romeo. Let's all remember that, you know, the only reason that the Liberals are passing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the implementing Bill C-15, is because it's basically Romeo's bill. So let's all just be aware that Romeo was the one who really should be getting credit. But of course, now that he's not in politics or he's in the NDP, the Liberals just kind of forget about that stuff. So,
right. Okay. Well, now you're two for two. You've got the names and the parties both. Okay. This one.
Anxiety. Okay.
This one, we're going a little bit back in history. Who said this? We also have no history of colonialism in Canada.
John A. MacDonald. That was John A. MacDonald who said, I believe he believed that. With every ounce of his heart.
It's premonition, though. We won't have any person.
The reincarnation of him was Stephen Harper.
Yes, exactly. Oh, and what party was he from again?
That was the, I'm going to say three options. The Reform / United Conservative / Canadian Lion / Conservative Party. So all of them, because they're just all basically the same thing.
Okay, that's awesome. Three for three. All right, this one is way back in history. Our objective is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada.
See, that's a tricky one, actually, because... It is. Say it again.
Our objective is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada. And so help me if you're using your phone. By the way, you can't use your phone. And there's no phone a friend.
The single Indian in Canada. I mean, obviously, Sir John A. is the one that kind of, the reason why I'm struggling is I'm like, is that a Duncan Campbell Scott thing? Like,
one or two dudes.
Yeah, I'm going to say Sir John A., of course, because I think that's more likely. Am I wrong? Duncan Campbell Scott. See, if it's Duncan Campbell Scott, you have to realize that, like, you have to dig in the archives for that one because, you know, like, he doesn't get to be the front person, he's the back person. Working hard to make sure that we all have terrible lives. So I take it back. I said Duncan Campbell Scott.
Okay, good. And I mean, Sir John A. said iterations of the same thing in many different ways. So it's kind of, but I always get those two mixed up.
And for the record, if I say both their names, then they both count. So there you go. It's like the postmodern answering.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Here's the next one. And this one is also going back in time, but not that far. First Nation. So he was referencing First Nations treaty chiefs. And he said, these people are threats to national security.
Oh, God.
But you can also pick the party, too. And you're good on if you just get the party. Like, what party would say were threats to national security?
I'm going to say Jason Kenney. But, I mean, the critical infrastructure bill. You could say that's Robert Borisov.
This is true. Okay, you know what? There should be like multiple answers for this because I didn't give you the whole contextual quote of like it was three lines.
Oh, I feel like I'm failing you and you're trying to give me excuses to give me half points.
No. So it was former Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, Bernard Valcourt.
Oh.
And he was testing. Yeah. Remember when the...
It said, who had crashed on a motorcycle and then therefore later said... that were threats to national security, I'd be like Valcourt for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, Valcourt. And, you know, then came Bill C-51 to try to surveil us all legally.
Who was the only person when they called for the national inquiry into murder, missing Indigenous women and girls to not stand up?
Oh my gosh. Yes, he was in the front row. How embarrassing. Okay.
Literally, and Tom Mulcair was famously beside him and he was like, oh, my, like, what is wrong with you?
That was so iconic. What an ass. Pardon my language. Okay, so that one was a tricky one.
But I think know that I should get half points for Jason Kenney. Okay, come on.
Because he had said those things too. Yeah, Jason Kenney for sure. And in fact,
he just passed a law for this exact sentiment, who then has been copied by Brian Pallister and been copied by now Aaron O'Toole in the Conservative Party platform. It's the exact same law.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, you could have just said conservatives general and it would have captured all those dudes. So we're good. Okay, here's the last one. And it might be tricky because I don't know if you follow this dude. He's a bit out there. So that's kind of a hint, like a bit out there. He said,
Brad Wall.
Okay. Trudeau's extreme multiculturalism and cult of diversity will divide us into little tribes.
I feel like that sounds like a Maxim Bernier.
Yes.
Okay.
And do you know his party?
The People's Party or something like
that. Yes, exactly.
CPC, the Canada People's Party, I think, isn't it?
We might
call it the Anti-Vaccination Party now.
The Anti-Vaxxers, yeah, I know, exactly.
And most importantly, arrested in southern Manitoba. Like, you got to work hard to be a white guy saying hateful things and still be arrested in southern Manitoba.
Oh my God. In a protest of like three people. I mean...
Like, there's a lot of racism in southern Manitoba. If you're white, you're pretty privileged down there. The cops are not looking for you. You got to do something pretty rough. And then on top of that, he's led an anti-vaccination, which is the center of anti-vaccination in Manitoba. And he was still arrested. That's pretty impressive.
It's phenomenal.
He was in town the other day facing his court charges. So there.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. It feels so wrongly satisfying. Okay, so let's get to the really hard questions. The first one is, why on earth are we having...
My typical grade was in school was like a C plus, a B. So I feel like I got a C plus at least in that. So.
Oh, you know, I'm giving you an A on that one.
Oh, that's...
You really only missed part of one.
I don't need pity grades, but okay, thank you.
I'm a good prof. Come on. Okay. You get an A. Okay, why are we having this election? Hello, it's summertime.
Okay, well, it's pretty basic, and this is a referendum on Trudeau's government, and the Trudeau basically sees the writing on the wall, and the writing on the wall is that there's a potential majority in play because he can make inroads in two major places. The first is Quebec, because there's a fundamental loss in bloc support because of a number of reasons, but I think for the most part, people didn't like how the Quebec government handled the pandemic, and they were under lockdown for such a long period of time. And so there's a potential there for Trudeau to break into Quebec and to have an opportunity there. That alone might spark a federal election because the Liberals haven't performed very well there. And certainly they're within majority reach, but they need to have Quebec to do that. The second is this very weakened Conservative Party, which... If you were to ask an everyday Canadian and say, who is the opposition leader? Most people would say Jason Kenney or the Canadian premiers instead of Aaron O'Toole. And so there's an opportunity there to see a weakened Conservative Party, and particularly weakened in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. There's a reason why, for example, that the two major announcements in this election campaign from the Liberals, the very first one, which was on the day before the writ was dropped, or the Friday before, which was the childcare announcement in Saskatchewan. That was a breakthrough for the Liberals. And then second is that the issues around Indigenous issues in relation to the campaign, Trudeau's been... wants to put that at the forefront, and was here as recently as last Friday. And so he sees possibilities in the prairies, which the Liberals haven't seen for quite a while. And that's why we're having an election, because the Liberals want a majority and they want to be able to express and push their agenda forward without the assistance of the NDP. But the fact is that in terms of Indigenous peoples, which are the ones that we're most interested in often writing or thinking, of course, that there are peoples, this is probably the most successful Canadian legislature for Indigenous peoples in history. Good, bad, great, ugly. Whether you would like the bills that have been passed for Indigenous languages, child welfare, even the United Nations Declaration, C-15, we talked about earlier, that's because of the role of the NDP in able to push the Liberals towards an agenda that isn't just resource-based, but is based in looking towards, you know, trying to deal with some of the major issues that are really breaking down the relationship, which is the issue of the non-recognition of Indigenous rights, Indigenous land claims, adequate consultation. And the fact is that we can't just continue to treat Indigenous peoples like mines to be exploited and be taken things from. And so the Liberals have shown in the past that they're interested in that. They have also shown that they have failed to deliver on their major promise, which is around boil water advisories. So I don't think the Liberals are to be trusted. And the current situation is probably more favorable to Indigenous peoples than it would be for Liberals to have a majority.
Okay, well, that explains a lot, because here we are, you know, still in this pandemic, you know, this fourth wave's coming, summer. I mean, hello, summer. And, you know, we're in an election, which
it is the positive work that the Liberals have done during the pandemic, which is generally favorable by Canadians.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, I would say favorable for most Indigenous nations, yeah, who saw that the Liberals prioritized and rightfully prioritized. Anybody who had any sense in their head should prioritize First Nations in terms, yeah, of the vaccine response, because we know that the vaccine will spread quicker, will damage more, will kill more on First Nations than it will be in Winnipeg or Calgary or Toronto. And so, so for good, bad, great, ugly, Canadians feel generally favorable of Trudeau's reaction to the pandemic. And that's really what's driving this federal election, because the upswing in support, if you look at all of the things the Liberals have really done over the past 3 years, most of them have been major faux pas. There's SNC-Lavalin, there's the We campaign, there's all the issues around the, you know, various scandals involving sexual harassment within the military. The Liberals have bungled so many different events. They should be failing in support, but they're getting support because of the pandemic.
Right. And we know, like, if you just look at it the other way, let's pretend that the Harper government was still in power, or it was an Aaron O'Toole government. We wouldn't have seen half the amount of pandemic supports for Canadians in general or Indigenous peoples. And I think that would have made a significant crisis even worse had it been under this, like, you know, no more bailouts, no more subsidies, work only programs kind of mantra of the Conservatives.
You lost me when you said Aaron O'Toole government. My brain exploded, started
apologies
right here, because I went like, that would never happen.
No,
first off, Aaron O'Toole is the most progressive Conservative in history. I mean, the guy supports LGBTQ rights. He supports issues around multiculturalism and inclusion. Like it's just a weird state that the Conservatives are in that they're trying to move towards the center, but the very foundation of the party is anti-LGBTQ rights, anti-immigration, anti-Indigenous people. Like, the fact is that you've got this weird situation where the leader of the Conservative Party doesn't really represent who Conservatives, for the most part, are. Certainly a loud vocal vocal amount of Conservatives. I don't want to say majority, because it really isn't a majority. I think most Conservatives tend to be kind of bouncing between the Liberals and the Conservatives, and so meaning a slightly socially aware. And so like, certainly, you know, the idea of Aaron O'Toole being a prime minister is frankly impossible in the current circumstance. His own party won't support him, never mind people in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so, well, that's a good segue into what the polls are saying about these parties, like who's even registering as having some kind of national support, and you know, do you think if it's any kind of real contest between the Liberals and the Conservatives?
Now, the only question of this campaign is, will the Liberals get into Quebec? Will the NDP, moving across the prairies, be able to withstand a Liberal majority? Those are the only two questions of this campaign. And the Conservatives, will they hold on to major strongholds, which is Alberta? Will they hold on to Saskatchewan? Will they maintain their support in rural Ontario? Like, that's really the only questions of this campaign, because the fact is that I think this is the last we're going to see of Aaron O'Toole, unless there's some major turnaround. I mean, he performed pretty good the first week. So So maybe there's, you know, like just like the T-shirt on the front of the conservative campaign thing, we all went, oh, Aaron O'Toole looks pretty good in a T-shirt. like we may be surprised by Aaron O'Toole. And I think the first week is somewhat surprising. He succeeded in this. The number one thing that the conservatives want is for Canadians to talk about conservatives. And they did. They successfully put out their platform. Everybody went, what the hell is this thing? And good, bad. Some people said it's good. Some people said it's bad. I think it's generally very bad for Indigenous peoples for the most part, even though it is the most interested and engaged Canadian conservative platform in history when it comes to Indigenous peoples, and says things like we should recognize Indigenous rights, but then like at the same time says, yeah, but we should arrest them when they go and stand up.
Exactly.
Doesn't make any sense at all. I wrote about that on my column on Saturday.
Yeah.
But the fact is that, you know, this is an election really about the Liberals, and will Canadians give the Liberals a majority in Quebec? Will they push them over the edge in Quebec? And really, Jagmeet Singh's performance, the fact that he's opened up his campaign trail in Alberta, like, what's that about? That just shows you that the failing support for Jason Kenney and the rise of Rachel Notley has resulted in Jagmeet Singh walking around Calgary in the first week of the campaign. Like who would have predicted that? Yeah. That just tells you that. But if you look at the polls, there's been a 5% drop in Alberta for the Conservatives and a 5% increase for the federal NDP. Jagmeet Singh is the most popular federal leader in Alberta by far.
Wow.
And so the fact is that will the Liberals be able to hold off the NDP in their support? That's the real question. Those are the two major questions. And I guess the third question is will Aaron O'Toole be able to hold on to the Conservative strongholds long enough to maintain his role as leader? I'm thinking not so much from what I'm seeing.
Okay, well, there's a question that I think about five Canadians would be really interested in hearing your response to. But first, I need to show you this little video. There's about five people who are very concerned about this. So for those of you who are listening on podcasts and not seeing on video, that was one of my TikToks where the infamous TikToker Native Dad is laughing in the background, and there's pictures of basically Maxime Bernier, leader of the People's Party of Canada, finding out essentially that he won't be able to participate in the federal leaders debate. And he is calling this essentially the work of the political cartel. So what are your thoughts on poor Maxime being booted out of the federal leaders debate?
I've already, just from this podcast alone, thought more about Maxime Bernier than I've ever thought before.
Yeah.
Because I just don't think about him. And you know, the one thing I was interested in that little TikTok video you showed, it did show him being arrested in southern Manitoba. So right. That's probably the most press that he's gotten in the past 2 years. Yeah. And it's because during the pandemic, when all of us were in lockdown here in Manitoba, he showed up to do a rally, and then the police immediately arrested him for inciting a large group function. And he was arrested for that, and he still is facing charges in southern Manitoba. Like, the fact is, Maxime Bernier has never had a party. It's been an illusion from the beginning. And the idea that he was able to sign up people to sign, like, I can get people to sign up for, if I said free ice cream cones, I could probably get 500 to sign up for something in an hour. Like, that's Maxime Bernier. If I said, okay, everybody, you can run for office, you're going to get 500 people to sign up for that. That doesn't mean they're candidates. That doesn't mean they're credible candidates. In fact, the fact that I remember we had this discussion in the media newsroom at the Free Press, and we said, oh, well, we found out that one of the Canadian People's Party candidates has said racist things. Should we run a story on it? And the question was, is like, what would be the point of it? Because we know that they're never going to be elected. We know that they are not a credible political party candidate. We know that they've never been vetted. This has never been a legitimate party. All this proves to you is that there is a measure of racism, of xenophobia, of stupidity and ignorance in this country, and it is in the upper echelons of political power, that Canadians still have those positions, and those can still get you. You can still be a privileged white man and get to the most highest offices of the land, almost become the leader of one of Canada's political parties, to, like, by a hair. Like, the guy almost got, you know, Andrew Scheer, almost beat Andrew Scheer. But it tells you that you can be to the highest offices in this land and still be a racist, still be xenophobic, still be so profoundly incorrect and ignorant on virtually every major issue. You could never read anything and still get to the echelons of power in this country. That is probably the only thing that we need to say about Maxime Bernier.
Yeah, and bye-bye. Bye-bye now.
Well, I mean, the question is like, why are we talking about somebody who is like, why does he get a position of in supposed civil debate in a federal election? Well, it's because there is a, well, there's two things there. One is the movement of Canadians to try to be inclusive, meaning to support racism as a legitimate form of dialogue, which it isn't.
No.
And so we should probably think about our values as a society when we say, okay, racism is not a civil form of dialogue. And the second is that you can do almost anything, spout hate, and still get 3% of support of the country. That shouldn't get you, just because you can promote hate, means that you shouldn't get a position in a major form of dialogue. And frankly, it's embarrassing that the media would humor that.
Yeah, exactly. I have, I've written this article for The Breach. It's going to come out either sometime today or tomorrow. So it'll already be out by the time this podcast is out, probably, where I actually did the painful job of looking through Maxime Bernier's platform and comparing it directly line by line with the conservative platform. And in fact, they're almost identical on all the things they care about, like making sure pipelines go through, stopping protesters, protecting the right of free speech so that there can't be any hate crime legislation, reducing immigration, stopping bogus asylum claims and refugees. So there's a real, although he's his own, whatever that weird party is, he is a product of the conservative government. And there's many people in the conservatives party, that actually share those views. They're just less in your face protesting about it.
I went to South Africa in 1994. Well, 1983 is actually when I was there, but 1993, 94. So I got to watch the Mandela election when I was 17. And it was probably the most remarkable experience of democracy that I ever had anyways, because what you saw is you saw people, Africans, literally from South Africa, who had experienced apartheid, and many of them had never voted before. So many people had couldn't read, because there was no schools for people, you know, who are Africans in South Africa. Of course, that's what racism does, right? Anyways, so there was this really interesting trend that happened in the election. So they had 23 political parties running for office, including Nelson Mandela, of course. And everybody knew Nelson Mandela was going to win. And the second place party was a party called the Inkatha Freedom Party, which was the Zulus, the other tribal community other than the Xhosas, which is what Mandela is. That's his tribe. Anyways, so because people couldn't read, and because people were so profoundly illiterate, they couldn't, they had to go by basically the pictures of how, what the candidates looked like. And because it was what we call a proportional ballot, you've only voted for the party. You didn't vote for candidates. Once the party got in, then they got to pick who the candidates were across the country. It's a different form of democracy. But anyways, so what the opposition parties did, there was 23 political parties. And what they did was they knew that Mandela was gonna win. So what they, lots of people did is they registered names like the African Men's Council, the AMC. And they would find the guy that most likely looked like Nelson Mandela and they put him on the ballot. So that when they got to the ballot and they got this ballot and they can't read, they would go like, okay, what does it look like? I'm looking for something that looks like ANC, and I'm looking for something that was looked like Nelson Mandela. And I just put my X beside that. And those parties who are basically a bunch of Yahoos who were basically trying their best to get some kind of form of role in the government, because you only had to get 3% of the national vote to then put candidates into the national government. And they did it. They got a percentage of support that they were able to put people in the government, very minor, ineffectual, rather irrelevant people. But that shows you that in any democracy, there is a level of absolutely illegitimate, irrelevant, and pointless views that will never enter into power, that are almost, why would you support such hate or such confusion or frank ignorance? Mm-hmm. And that reminds me, when you talk about Maxime Bernier, of my experience in South Africa.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, let's get to what we know. We know right now the Conservatives, their platform is online. The NDP's platform is online. We don't have a platform for the Liberals, unless I didn't check this morning, but there wasn't yesterday. They said they were going to wait closer to potentially the debates. Any idea why the Liberals wouldn't have their platform up right now like the rest of them?
Because they don't need to. They've got a track record that they can debate on. And frankly, the Liberals, like, why would they put something out that people can attack? The job of the Liberals is to keep the ship steady and to keep it moving. Run on your record. Try to avoid the major minefields, which are SNC-Lavalin. By the way, you know, Jody Wilson-Raybould isn't running, so they don't have to worry about that issue as much anymore. Don't ride on the issues around the We campaign. Notice that Pierre Poilievre and other conservatives are trying to bring up the issues of the We campaign. And then, of course, most recently, the issues around the harassment in the military and other things that the Liberals have slipped up upon and made major mistakes upon. Just try to avoid those issues the best that you can. Because as soon as you put out a party platform, then you have a track record to compare it to. And so what'll happen is that you say, okay, well, we're going to fix boil water advisories, right? Let's say that's on First Nations. Well, the first question would be is, didn't you promise that already? And like, why didn't you deliver on the first 5 years in office? So as soon as you put out a party platform, you say that it's a statement of things to say that you haven't done. So, of course, you don't put out a power party platform. It shouldn't be surprising. And what you should be, they're probably going to be releasing it only when they have to, which is when Trudeau is going to face it in a debate. So probably the day before, something to give the Conservatives the most minimal time possible to read it and to pick apart and so on. And for Canadians to be aware of it as well. So it'll be released much later. Frankly, if at all, because in it may just be parsed out over a number of other documents. That if I were in the Liberal strategy room, I would say your best job is for Canadians to only think about you who already support you, and to give people reasons to support you in certain strategic areas of the country, like the child care plan. Like the issues around the pandemic response. Keep talking about the economic recovery, because that will get you into Alberta. I think that would be generally, if I was in the Liberal strategy room, that's what I would be saying. Unfortunately, Indigenous peoples lose on that issue because the Liberals have been so porous on it. They have really, poverty has increased, as an example. The only thing the Liberals have done to solve poverty is they've moved the market basket measure, which is the way that we assess poverty, which is basically the price of a basket of goods. What they've done is they've said, oh, well, it's less than we thought. So therefore, 150,000 people overnight were classified and defined as being out of poverty, where nothing had been invested. They just defined it differently. And so that's what the Liberals have done with poverty. And guess who's the ones in poverty? That's us. That's our people. And so, you know, the fact is that the Liberals have really failed on issues involving Indigenous peoples. For the most part, they have given little things like the Indigenous Languages Act. By the way, that act will never save any Indigenous languages. It's mostly like an after-school program. It'll fund, that's about it. And then the child welfare bill, which has had very mixed results. I would say generally First Nations are happy about it, but they aren't happy that they haven't had any funding attached to it, because the province is still gripped with their cold, dead hand, every penny in Indigenous child welfare.
You were just listening to Pam Palmatter's Warrior Life podcast from August 25th, 2021.
You can catch all her content and donate to her show at pampalmatter.com. We'll be right back. That concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or news intern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram, Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook. Search for us, just CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir à tous et bienvenue à Café, votre émission d'art et culture du vendredi sur CKUT. Ici Ève Laurence au micro et j'ai l'honneur ce soir de vous présenter une œuvre musicale d'un artiste que l'on admire beaucoup ici à Café, James Carnes, du projet de Taxil Hoax, basé à Montréal. Alors pour la prochaine heure, vous allez pouvoir entendre une composition sous forme de mixtape qui rassemble plusieurs segments épars enregistrés par l'artiste au cours des deux dernières années. C'est souvent le défi auquel sont confrontés les artistes prolifiques. Ils et elles créent trop de bon matériel, ils composent beaucoup, ils enregistrent, mais des fois c'est difficile d'utiliser ce matériel-là de manière cohérente sous forme d'album. Alors, plutôt que de sortir un album, The Taxil Hoax a opté pour un format qui permet la juxtaposition et l'enchaînement de segments pour créer une œuvre enivrante qui nous permet de vraiment se laisser aller, se laisser emporter et naviguer à travers différentes courtes chansons qui allient guitare et musique ambiante électronique. La mixtape s'intitule « Meditation on the UFO Phenomenon », ce qui révèle sa thématique, une thématique mystique, surnaturelle, sur l'inexplicable phénomène des objets volants non identifiés, les ovnis.